From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Television producer and director Gregory Hoblit has won 7 Emmys for his work on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about breaking the rules in television, and we preview his new made-for-TV movie based on the Roe v. Wade case that legalized abortion. Also today, we meet Kurt Hoffman, composer and saxophonist with The Ordinaires, a band one critic described as playing bohemian art music. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 3 new comeback albums from Dion, Phoebe Snow, and Donny Osmond. And film critic Stuart Klawans reviews the new British comedy, How to Get Ahead in Advertising. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. If the name Gregory Hoblit sounds familiar, yet you can't place it, it's probably because you've seen it roll by in the credits of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. Hoblit worked as both a producer and director of Hill Street Blues and won 4 Emmys for the show. In 1987, he won Emmys as co-executive producer of L.A. Law and director of the pilot episode. And in 1988, he won an Emmy for directing the pilot of Hooperman. Hoblit directed a new made-for-TV movie called Roe vs. Wade. It will be broadcast May 15th on NBC's Monday Night at the Movies. It tells the story of the case that legalized abortion. Amy Madigan plays the attorney who argued the case in Texas, then took it to the Supreme Court. Holly Hunter stars as the woman who wanted to terminate her pregnancy and agreed to become the anonymous plaintiff in a class action suit. Abortion is a loaded subject for television. I asked Hoblit if he had to show the script to representatives of both sides of the issue.
We didn't have to do that at all, no. I don't think we were obligated to, but the script was seen in its various stages by the people upon whom it was based, namely Flowers and Floyd and Sarah and Norman. Norma, they all read the script as it was being written. They have all seen the movie. We really went to great lengths, I would say, to maintain the integrity of their feelings and thoughts and at the time.
So the lawyers on both sides of the case and the plaintiff all read the script.
Oh yes.
And did they suggest changes that you made?
They were interested in accuracy. I mean, Sarah would be interested. She says, I wouldn't have said that. Or this date or this action, this activity didn't take place in this time. J. Floyd the same. Norma the same. They were really concerned that they were portrayed in a way that made them comfortable.
Network standards and practices usually deals with advocacy groups. Did you have to report to standards and practices on the script, and did they have any suggested revisions?
Oh yes, but standards and practices was not in position per se as it used to be. It may be in the future because of all the heat that this movie and is taking, and you know the problems now with other programs and other networks that are taking some heat. This project was begun 4 years ago and was sort of wound its way through the legal and standards and practices machinery of the network over that period of time, often bottlenecked, utterly stuck, as there were concerns over the legal aspects of it, the balance of it, the possibility of advocacy groups mounting campaigns against it, as we're now seeing.
What kind of campaigns have there been against this movie?
Well, from reading the LA Times this morning, and I just quoted an article out of the New York Times, there have been a number of groups. Most notably, I think, Reverend Wildman, is that his name, from
mm-hmm.
Tupelo,
mm-hmm.
who has begun a letter-writing campaign. Has said a number of things about the movie, portraying it as is positively pro-choice. He has never seen the movie. He admits to that. He just seems to feel free to make those pronouncements. And I gather there's a number of other groups. I read a letter a while back from a woman from New Jersey who who in essence said if certain things weren't in the movie and she could be assured of it, that she would mount a boycott against any consumers, companies wanting to promote their products on the movie.
Let me ask you this: since the Supreme Court decision was pro-choice, is there anything wrong if the movie is pro-choice?
Well, there's two aspects to that. The Supreme Court did give it a point of view, you know, historically, politically, socially. There's no doubt about it. It came down on the side of Roe. By telling the story of Norma McCorvey and following her from day one of her having to grapple with her situation to her meeting Sarah Weddington to mounting the case that was going to challenge an 1865 statute in Texas prohibiting abortion, it's clear that the story comes down weighted towards Norma and Sarah. So from the Supreme Court gave it a point of view, and the storytelling gave it a point of view. I would like to think, however, that in our distilling the transcripts from the Supreme Court and the District Court in Dallas, evenly and accurately on both the J. Floyd side and Sarah Weddington's side, that we articulated the legal points made by both sides very clearly.
In other words, you can have a point of view and still be fair in how you treat both sides.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And there was a need on part of the network to do that, and a need on my part to do it too, and Michael's and Allison's. Theirs was different than mine. Mine was, or ours, I should say, was more creative. I would maintain that you don't have good drama unless you have conflict. And inherent to this story, there wasn't much conflict. There was not big battles on Sarah's in Sarah's circle about what she was doing. There were not big battles in J. Floyd's section about what he was doing. The two of them didn't meet in an elevator in a restaurant in a hallway and get into an argument. The way then to set up some kind of dramatic tension, and also I think make very clear what the case was for both of them, both personally and legally, was to carefully articulate their feelings. So to lay out clearly J. Floyd's feelings and scenes like the barbecue scene where he talks about saline solution and a fetus sucking its thumb at a certain time and his need to win this case simply clarified and made more dramatic, I think, Sarah's position. And conversely, the more Sarah talked about what she did and what she was feeling, the more clearly it set up what Floyd was doing. And in the end, you have the best of both worlds. It does none of us any good just to have a polemic or a one-sided discussion. It gets boring.
Rolling Stone reported that when the movie was in production, it was given the name Common Knowledge instead of Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
Because that way the subject wouldn't be that obvious and you wouldn't risk as many protests. One, is that true? And two, were there any protests anyways during the production?
Yes, it is true, and there were no protests. We succeeded in avoiding any problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Holly Hunter plays the role of the plaintiff in the Roe versus Wade case. She's a member of the National Abortion Rights Action League. Was it important to you to cast someone who had a pro-choice point of view in the role?
No. Michael and I just wanted to cast the best actor we could find.
Mm-hmm.
Holly's point of view in politics aside, she was absolutely right for this role, and we went for her. And I was and quite surprised, frankly, that she did it. She took it. I mean, Holly doesn't exactly need this in terms of advancing her career, but she was interested in the script. And the character was someone who just galvanized her in terms of someone that she could play. And she said yes.
The film doesn't use the real name of the plaintiff, Norma McCorvey. Did she not give her permission?
No, a debate went on back and forth between she and Michael Mannheim for actually a couple of years with regard to that. Michael gave her the option. She said, "You can or you cannot." You at that time, she really wanted to remain anonymous. She was a little afraid of the spotlight. And literally up until the day we started shooting, it was in Norma's hands whether or not she wanted to be called Norma in this movie or Ellen, as we call her. But once we started shooting and the first characters called Ellen, the die was cast. Since that time, she's become very active, as you know, doing lots of talk shows and interviews, and was at a march in Washington a while back. And probably if we were to do it over again at this point, she would be Norma in the movie and not Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Gregory Hoblit is my guest, and he's won several Emmys for his work on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman, and he produced and directed the made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which will air on NBC this Monday evening. What keeps you in television, as opposed to wanting to do feature films?
Oh, I would like to do feature films. Mm-hmm. I would just like to find a piece of material that would light me up. I've had the very good fortune over the years of working on L.A. Law and Hill Street to have been in touch with material, and the writers who write it and the actors who act it, that is better, I would say, maybe somewhat arrogantly, but I'll say it anyway, better than 90% of the movies being made. And Hill Street in particular and L.A. Law 2, those handful of episodes that we would do each year that were really, really fine, I felt were as good as any feature, well, as good as most features that are being made.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up. I felt that at our best we were good, as good or better than the vast number of features being made, or all but a few.
Were you in on Hill Street at the very beginning?
Yeah, I produced the pilot.
You did. What
yes.
was the look you were going after?
Well, I believe it was a PBS documentary. Now, this is 1980 or 79 when I saw this, called The Police Tapes, which was a 16mm, actually, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't. It was handheld black and white video of the Fort Apache precinct in the Bronx, and it was about 4 hours of tapes of the comings and goings of policemen in that urban environment that was fascinating. And, you know, the herky-jerky camera and the rough dialogue, and it was mean and kind of inelegant. And when Michael Kozel and Stephen Bochco handed me the script, I said, well, there's a certain way we can do this that I think it'll make it uncommon for television and not make it like Adam 12 or something.
Mm.
And they both lit up to that. We also found a director and a man named Robert Butler, who was kind of a renegade in his own right and really was out to break some rules. And we just set about designing that set and the uniforms and creating the environment to try to make it look and taste and feel and smell like a real inner city urban precinct under siege from its environment, from its community. Michael and Stephen just wrote words that just inspired the kind of lunacy that we began to employ in terms of the camera, in terms of the characters that we cast, in terms of the sound that you heard over the air. It was a lot of fun. Boy, we had a good time.
I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Gregory Hoblit, who's produced and directed for Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman, and he's the producer-director of the made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which will air on NBC this coming Monday night. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Gregory Hoblit is my guest. You were telling us about some of the rules that you went about breaking when you started doing Hill Street Blues. Let's talk about some of the rules that you broke. Handheld camera. You had seen that in the tapes that you were talking about on PBS of the Fort Apache precinct.
Yes.
You worked with a handheld camera on Hill Street.
Yes. A lot of the time, but not all the time.
It would be kind of gimmicky if you used it all the time.
Pardon me?
It would probably be gimmicky if you used it all the time.
Well, it would also make you seasick. Our first inclination was to present to the network that we wanted to make this in 16mm, black and white, handheld all the way. That did not fly very well with Bran the Tartikoff and those folks over there at the time. But we found, you know, we found a midpoint that we could agree upon, and one was a kind of judicious and effective use of handheld. I mean, in the roll call scenes and the fights and certain street activity. We also degraded the film. I remember saying to Billy Kronjager, who was the director of photography on the pilot, the idea would be to take the film in the morning in its raw stock form and kind of run it out on the parkway outside the soundstage and have a couple trucks roll over it and then roll it back up, stick it in the magazine and stick it in the camera and shoot. And just so it would have that dense, ugly look. In truth, what we did is we underdeveloped and then we pushed the film to give it that grainy kind of quality.
Mm-hmm. The Hill Street also always had a really crowded, chaotic feel to it, especially the scenes in the precinct.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways you achieved that was through the overlapping dialogue, because there were always, like, dozens of conversations happening simultaneously.
Yes. I mean, in real life, people don't finish sentences. They're inarticulate. They stumble, as I'm doing on this show. They overlap each other. They don't wait for the other person to finish. And what we would do is construct the scenes in terms of the writing of them that allowed for that. And so people would overlap and interrupt each other. Also, if you remember, a lot of the scenes, or a disproportionate number of the scenes, were shot in one shot. One long shot, sometimes weaving through the precinct, or sometimes just at a desk, where there were no edits. And so anybody in that scene who was speaking would just kind of tumble in on top of the other. I remember one scene that I did sometime in year three is probably the most satisfying Hill Street that I ever did, where there was something like 18 speaking parts in a 2.5-page scene or a 3-minute piece altogether with no edits in it. It's kind of risky, but it's great fun if you can pull it off. You then lay in on top of that the background group. By that I mean we go into, after we're all finished shooting and it's edited together and it's in its proper form, then I would get a loop group, they're called. And this would be 8 to 10 people to stand in a room with microphones around, look at the picture, and pretend they're the crowd that's surrounding the principals who are speaking.
Oh, no.
And they would make up their own little scenes. They would make up, you know, this drama or that drama and this discussion about this or that, and then we just lay that in on top of the principal speaking, and that's how you got that sense of just ongoing density and chaos.
That's really interesting. You know, I had read in an article that another thing you did was bring in a comedy group to ad-lib humor lines that you could use in the script.
Well, that's the same group.
That's the same group.
The loop group is the group. I mean, they are. It's not uncommon anymore in L.A. And in movies and in television. There are a lot of improvisational groups out of Second City. In this case, it was an outfit called the Super Loopers. Off the Wall at the time, they're now called the Super Loopers. I used the same group, by the way, in Roe vs. Wade, to be the background in courtrooms, to be the background in the carnival that you saw early on, in any number of other places, in restaurants. They're all actors. And they tend to, it's good to have comedy actors in there who often are very fast on their feet and can ad-lib very easily. And you just put the picture up and you say, I would like some sense of this attitude over in this group of people that you see over on the right-hand side of the screen. They're in an intense, dramatic conversation about a murder. And over on the left, they're in an intense, funny conversation about, you know, somebody found a duck in their car. Now just create a scene and they'll go and do it.
So we're hearing the same voices on all these different shows.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Producer and director Gregory Hoblit is my guest, and he's worked on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, Hooperman, and he produced and directed the new made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which airs Monday night. Hill Street Blues, I think, has really had a pretty big effect on subsequent television shows. And, you know, we talked a little bit about some of the production things that you did on Hill Street. Let's talk a little bit about working with broadcast standards and practices. Do you feel that you push the limits of what you could show on television in terms of violence or sex?
They would think so.
Uh-huh.
We just were trying to do, in language.
In language, yeah.
We were just trying to do our work. Stephen and Michael and the rest of the writers would sit and construct stories. And the stories would then take on a life of their own and a language of their own. And they would have all those elements in them. They write it. We send it over the network. The network, you know, either said this is fine, not a problem, or they would go crazy and say, you can't say this on television. You can't show that. You can't talk about this or that. And then we'd get embroiled in why not? Well, it's bad taste, or it's offensive, or it's too controversial, or it's that language is not appropriate. And then you'd say, well, why not? And this would go back and forth. And Stephen really was the standard bearer on this in terms of the show. He knew what he wanted, and he knew what he wanted to hear and say. No question he was offended when people over there who had a different vested interest were trying to interfere in his creative rights or what he perceived to be his creative rights. And the give and take would go on and on, but slowly but surely we would push back the line which they were trying to draw. And it wasn't bullying back, I would like to think, although they might think that. It was, we'll show you how we can do this and how we can do this in good taste. And in, you know, exhibiting some good manners in the course of it all. And
what's an example?
Well, one that comes to mind immediately. I shot it was a scene in Joyce Davenport's apartment in her jacuzzi bathtub, which was going to have Daniel Travanti and Veronica Hamill ostensibly naked in this bathtub as the bubbles were swirling around, and they said, absolutely not. We cannot have two people whose shoulders are bare and backs are bare in on screen at the same time, of a different sex. And it was like, why not? Well, we just can't, and you can't do it. And then we said, well, we're going to do it. And they said, no, you're not going to do it. And we said, well, we are going to do it. And then it was like, well, can you do it two ways? One, so they're really way underwater, or the bubbles are very high, and one the way that you want to do it, and we'll see. Well, the secret's out now. We would really only do it one way, because I didn't want them coming back and saying, well, we didn't like that, let us see the other one. And I'd do it one way and show it to them, and almost 100% of the time they would say, that's okay. And in this case, they said, that's okay, and that stopped being a boogeyman. That stopped being a problem. So from that point on, there were any number of scenes with Daniel and Veronica in the bathtub or in a shower, a bit more intimate and more real in bed scenes. That same situation has carried over to L.A. Law, where there are scenes amongst our principals that I think 5, 6, 7 years ago we never would have been able to do. Now they don't even raise an eyebrow.
I guess if they didn't like what you had given them and only shot one way, you would have been out of a job.
Well, no, I wouldn't have been out of a job. We would have probably had to end up shooting it again.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They weren't going to fire us. They weren't good. I mean, any number of times, I've got to tell you, Stephen in particular and me in spirit would say to them, well, we're going to take our football and go home now. Call us when you want to talk seriously about this.
Uh-huh.
We can do something else. If you don't want Hill Street to go on, we'll stop. I remember back in 1980 when we started making the pilot, there was a particular actor that the head of casting and NBC did not want us to use. He'd had some problem with this guy in the past, or didn't like him as an actor, or there'd been some bad history. And he said, no, you can't use him. And I remember Michael and Steven and I were walking up a stairway to our offices at MTM, and Steven turned to both of us and said, well, are we prepared to walk? And we both said, yeah, we can do something else. This is not going to, and we can figure out how to pay our mortgages some other way. Put in the call to the network saying, we either have this actor in our pilot, or we don't do the pilot. And back came a very quick answer, you got your actor. And that's how we proceeded.
Why did you finally leave?
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
5 years was a long time. I made in that course of time, in that period of time, about 120 episodes. I was tired. Steven left. They asked me to stay and take over his position, and I didn't really want to do that. I just wanted fresh air, like the name of this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out and did a few things, not much, in a period of time between the end of L.A. Law, the end of Hill Street and the beginning of L.A. Law. Doing series is very difficult. It really just grinds you into a pulp. It's 7 days a week. It's 12 to 16 hours a day.
It's like making a little movie every week.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to, and that's what we sought to do. It was really to try to make a feature, 1 hour feature film every week. And we could have made it for less money. We could have made it absolutely on time and for budget, I suppose. We could have had our weekends to ourselves, gone home early, but we never would have had Hill Street Blues as it was, unless we did what we did.
What do you think the greatest effects of Hill Street have been on the industry?
Geez, that would be somewhat presumptuous to assess. I would just like to think, in keeping what we've talked about with regards to broadcast standards and material, that those doors were opened mm-hmm. appreciably by Hill Street. Also, and it also inspired, inspired other people as talented as Stephen and Michael and other writers we've had on that show to step up and try to do things. And out of that came some very good St. Elsewhere and Miami Vice when it began. While in terms of content, I would never applaud it. I think they really took some great chances cinematically and in style. 30-something most recently, Cagney and Lacey. I suppose, and I have to be careful how I say this, but I'll say it anyway, that they owe something to Hill Street for having opened the door for programmers at all three networks to know that that kind of work could exist in terms of content, in terms of acting, in terms of style. I'm really pretty proud of that show, I must say.
I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Gregory Hoblit has won Emmys for his work on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. He's the producer and director of the made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, a dramatization of the landmark abortion rights case, which airs on NBC this Monday night. It stars Holly Hunter and Amy Madigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Rosabeth Moss Cantor. She's one of the most sought-after business speakers in the world. She holds an endowed chair as professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, and she's the author of many books, including Men and Women of the Corporation and The Change Masters. Her new book is about new business strategies for the 90s. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Ordinaires are a band with two guitars, two violins, two saxophones, a cello, bass, and drums. One critic said they sound like a shopping binge at a musical Kmart. Coming up, composer and saxophonist Kurt Hoffman takes a stab at describing the band. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new comeback albums from Dion, Phoebe Snow, and Donny Osmond. And film critic Stuart Klawans reviews How to Get Ahead in Advertising, a new comedy about an ad man obsessed with his job. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President Bush announced today that he is sending some 2,000 additional troops to Panama to protect American citizens and the Panama Canal. Bush also said he is recalling the U.S. ambassador there, removing all non-essential diplomatic personnel, and relocating U.S. government personnel who are living outside U.S. protection. NPR's Jim Angle reports from the White House.
The president's action was taken, said officials, in order to prevent American citizens from being subjected to the same kind of violence taken against General Manuel Noriega's political opponents. President Bush, after consulting with leaders of Congress and other nations in the hemisphere, made the announcement late this afternoon at the White House.
I'm worried about the lives of American citizens, and I will do what is necessary to protect the lives of American citizens, and we will not be intimidated by the bullying tactics, brutal though they may be, of the dictator Noriega.
American personnel living on Panamanian territory will be relocated outside Panama or moved to areas in Panama under U.S. jurisdiction. The president said the United States will assert and exercise its rights under the Panama Canal treaties. The president did not make clear how far U.S. forces are prepared to go to protect those rights. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today offered to make unilateral cuts in short-range nuclear weapons as part of a new proposal on missile reductions. Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze told a news conference Gorbachev had presented the offer to Secretary of State James Baker at the end of a two-day visit to Moscow. Baker, who arrived in Brussels after his meetings in Moscow, told reporters the Soviet proposal on short-range nuclear forces was not enough to draw the United States into negotiations on these weapons. Baker said it was a good step, but a very small step towards a more equal balance in Europe. Arms dealer Richard Secord has been indicted on 9 more charges in the Iran-Contra affair. The indictment, unsealed today in Washington, charges Secord with lying to Congress. The retired Air Force general already faces 6 charges for his alleged role in the scandal. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
In May of 1987, arms dealer Richard Secord, a retired Air Force major general, volunteered to testify on Capitol Hill. Unlike Oliver North or former National Security Advisor John Poindexter or others involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, Secord offered to testify without any guarantee of immunity from prosecution. Secord testified for 5 days, and now a federal grand jury has charged that he lied over and over again and obstructed the congressional inquiry. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh announced the indictment today, noting that it had been filed a month ago but was kept sealed because of the ongoing Oliver North trial. If convicted on the original 6 charges he was indicted for, Secord faces 24 years in prison. If convicted on the 9 charges he was charged with today, he faces up to 45 years in prison and millions of dollars in fines. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The FBI doesn't have enough evidence to seek an indictment, despite the CIA's conclusion that Iran was responsible for last year's bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland. The Washington Post reported today that the CIA has concluded that Iran hired a Syrian-based Palestinian organization to carry out the operation. House and Senate negotiators have agreed on a $1.17 trillion budget for fiscal 1990. The spending plan cuts defense spending while leaving a deficit of $99.7 billion. The full House and Senate are expected to give final approval to the document next week. The Bush administration today sent Congress legislation calling for a $500 million federal oil cleanup fund, which would be financed by a fee on domestic and imported oil. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial Average gained more than 8 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three new albums from three singers who have virtually nothing in common, except that they're trying for comebacks. You might think you need a beauty queen. You might want a California dream. Some guys fancy a Monroe lookalike, but my girl sent me high than a rocket. What's her name? What's her game? Sound the same, she come walking down the street. You're frightened. She's all right with me.
There's nothing more difficult to pull off in popular music than a comeback. As a musician, you establish your career with a certain sound, a certain style, a certain song. Then, for whatever reasons, your career begins to fade and you fall out of the public's consciousness. Eventually, you muster all your strength and talent and probably money for one more major effort. There are, of course, a lot of attempted comebacks that don't succeed. Just a few months ago, for example, Carole King, after a long recording silence, put out an album called City Streets that's failed to produce a hit. But sometimes it works. It did for Tina Turner about 5 years ago, and it worked more recently for Roy Orbison, first as part of the Traveling Wilburys, and then with an absolutely first-rate solo album that's gone into the top 10 since his death. Right now, there seem to be a number of very different musicians mounting comebacks. Carl Perkins, for example, has just put out a pop country album. The phony baloney rockabilly band The Stray Cats is trying to sucker us in again, and Dolly Parton is about to release her first pure country album in quite a few shaky years. And there's more. There is, for example, Dion DiMucci of Dion and the Belmonts fame. His new album is called Yo Frankie. You know, I floored my accelerator all the way to the equator. Just a local gladiator. If I'm a king of the New York streets, well, I was only 16 years. So what could I have known in my mind these passing years? The legend sure has gone. You know, people come from miles around to see my rough tenement crown. Always object, never down, king of the New York street. Check it out. Schools gave me nothing needed. To my throne I proceeded. Every warning went unheeded. Yeah, king of the New York street. We walked off. That's Dion and King of the New York Streets. This new album has some healthy momentum behind it. Dion was back in the public eye earlier this year when he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Lou Reed made a moving speech about the influence of Dion's white rhythm and blues style. The new album features Lou Reed singing backup vocals, as well as guest stars ranging from Paul Simon to K.D. Lang. But as you heard, its songs rely a bit too heavily on your nostalgia for old Dion and the Belmonts hits like Run Around Sue and The Wanderer. If you don't feel that nostalgia, you might not be drawn in by this record. Phoebe Snow, on the other hand, is doing her best to avoid easy nostalgia on her first album in 8 years, called Something Real. I must admit I've always thought of Phoebe Snow as one of those singers who's so wrapped up in her technical accomplishments that she doesn't let much emotion or spontaneity into her music. In other words, I admire her skill, but I've never been a fan. There's a lot to admire on this new album, though, and there are a few songs that even overcome my reservations. Getting myself together. Tomorrow.
That's Phoebe Snow and If I Can Just Get Through the Night. It would be presumptuous of me to assume that Phoebe Snow's long absence from the recording scene has made her more daring, but there's definitely a looser, go-for-broke quality on this album. Finally, we come to the most surprising, even shocking, comeback of all. Donny Osmond is back, and he's got an honest-to-gosh hit single called Soldier of Love. Donny was a pop culture joke in the 70s, part of the sappy Osmond family, singer of treacly songs with his sister Marie. These days, Donny is looking pensive and moody, decked out like George Michael in a leather jacket, with three-day-old stubble on his chin, or maybe it's 10 years of accumulated peach fuzz. Soldier of Love is derivative of both George Michael and Prince, but it's not a bad pop single at all, and its current position in the top five proves that in this business, absolutely anyone can make a comeback.
That's Donny Osmond. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. The Ordinaires are a New York-based nine-piece band that came out of the art music scene of the early 80s. Their music combines the jazz, rock, and classical backgrounds of the members. It's an eclectic mix, but music critic Peter Watrous said that instead of being lightweight, most of the writing unhinges clichés, recombined familiar musical postures sound fresh again. Kurt Hoffman is the band's tenor saxophonist and one of its two main composers. He's featured on clarinet in this composition by fellow Ordinaire Fritz Van Orden. How the Ordinaires came together? Was it because of someone was looking for this unusual instrumentation, or was it the personalities that came together?
Well, a couple of different things. I guess first there was a band that preceded the Ordinaires, which was an attempt at a big band, which was consciously put together as a saxophone and guitar orchestra, and that led to the Ordinaires. We brought in violins instead of quite as many saxophones as we had, because it could, we could depict a lot of different kinds of music and say a lot of things with a more varied instrumentation. It was more or less consciously put together to be this sort of mini orchestra.
So now you find yourself writing for a band that has two saxophonists, two guitarists, two violinists, a cello,
bass and drums.
It's not your typical group to compose for. Let me ask you about a composition that I assume you wrote for the Ordinaires, so Racing Thoughts.
Yeah, I wrote that. Well, obviously, it hinges on a quote from Jimi Hendrix at the very beginning, and the structure of it is actually more or less lifted from a symphony that Mozart wrote when he was about 13 years old. But of course, I've completely rewritten both motifs, both the motif and the structure, to produce something that's Ordinaire's music.
It's kind of fun to have this this like rock riff breaking into chamber music and then back again.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the psychedelic experience, which is something that's obviously been a major influence on rock. But I think that we're actually depicting it in more of a literal way by actually doing something that does the transforming and right before your eyes, you know, rather than producing the sort of music which might be the backdrop for a psychedelic experience, like, I don't know, traditional psychedelic music.
You use the word psychedelic. What's made you interested in the psychedelic music experience?
Well, I went through a period where I was experimenting with psychedelic drugs. Well, that's over now. But I still have lots of flashbacks. Yep, that's it. That's why I was interested, because I had a pretty good time and it was really interesting, and now I'm trying to tell the world about it in music.
Let me ask you about another composition on here.
Okay.
Brenda, which starts off kind of like pulse music in a way, and then, you know, different instruments keep getting added and then the pulse keeps changing.
Uh-huh.
It's a good piece.
Yeah, it's actually, I guess it's the earliest piece we ever did, and I guess because it's our earliest piece, you can kind of get a glimpse of what we were doing when we first started out, which was we were approaching the synthesis through something that was more like minimalism, which was both a technically easy way to approach arranged music, since we hadn't arranged music before, you know, and it's also forceful driving and relevant to the pop form.
Did the Ordinaires get together?
1982.
And what was happening around that time in the music places that you used to go to and play in?
Yeah, it was kind of a different scene than it is now. I think that one thing that was happening then that seemed interesting at the time, it still seems interesting to me in retrospect, doesn't seem to be happening now, were that people that were creating rock bands that were more like modernist sculpture exhibitions or something, I guess there were bands like Glenn Branca and Peter Gordon and Theoretical Girls who were sort of stepping outside the traditional rock myth or pop myth in order to make something that was both pop and some sort of an art statement. And that was certainly what I was interested in doing. And I think that's sort of the impulse that started the Ordinaires. And I think to a certain extent we're still a little bit like that. I don't think we're quite as self-conscious as a lot of the art bands of the, you know, late 70s, early 80s were. But in a way, I think that element makes us kind of stand out from the current crowd of bands, which I think the traditional rock myth has sort of resurfaced as something to be embraced once again, even if you do it in an inventive or alternative way.
What's made you think about that rock myth coming back again, even in art music?
Well, I think a lot of the sort of people that either were in bands in the late 80s or younger bands that are trying to create an interesting alternative to the mainstream, they kind of explode the traditional rock structure and sound, but you know it's really about you know pose and attitude and you know of a certain sort. I guess I see a lot of bands that like Live Skull and Sonic Youth, who to a certain extent toe a certain line that I think enables a lot of you know kids that are just kind of into rock to be able to get into their music. I think that we step back from that line a bit. You know, at times, you know, it probably will alienate some people from us.
The last piece on the new album is Kashmir. It's a Led Zeppelin song.
Yeah.
What prompted you to do this?
Well, you know, you got to do covers, you know.
We spoke with Kurt Hoffman, composer and saxophonist with The Ordinaires. Their new album, One, is on Bar None Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll have the latest on the Panama situation. It is changing there by the minute. There is another sort of ceasefire in effect in Beirut. 9 more charges disclosed today against retired Air Force General and arms dealer Richard Secord. He's accused of lying to Congress. Also, morels in Montana, in the mountains, said to be wonderfully plentiful this spring. And we'll talk with Ian Whitcomb. Ian Whitcomb is a British pop star, and he has written a book called Irving Berlin and Ragtime America. He'll be telling some stories and singing some songs that belong to Mr. Berlin on the occasion of Berlin's 101st birthday.
Thanks, Noah. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. How to Get Ahead in Advertising is not a training film. It's a new comedy by the British writer and director Bruce Robinson about salesmanship and guilt. Film critic Stuart Klawans has this review.
People say that the sign of a true artist is the ability to make us look squarely at things we'd rather not face. If so, then Bruce Robinson has definitely proved his artistry in How to Get Ahead in Advertising. This is a movie about pimples, or as the English call them, boils. Our protagonist, Bagley, is the hottest ad agency writer in London. He's supposed to be working on a campaign for a new pimple cream. But nothing comes to him. He can't bring himself to think about pimples. They're the worst thing he's had to deal with since the campaign about hemorrhoids, or as the English call them, piles. The pimple cream is so much on his mind, in fact, that he can't even enjoy a quiet lunch with his wife.
Everything will be all right. You've had these sort of problems many, many times before.
Not like this, I haven't.
Oh, yes, you have. What about piles? You had a terrible time with piles.
I did not have a terrible time with piles. All right, I may have had a problem getting a hold of them, but selling them was a piece of cake.
You're raising your voice, darling.
Compared to this, piles were a birthday present. So was dandruff. So was breath.
You're still raising your voice, darling.
I tell you, Julia, the whole lot taken together, including lawnmowers, is as nothing compared to the pimples, acne, and boils.
So one day, Bagley snaps. he gets an attack of conscience and declares he's through with advertising. In fact, he's going to expose advertising as a threat to humanity. For the first time, he has a purpose in life. He's happy. He's free. His wife finds him naked in the bathroom at dawn, with household products splattered all over and a frozen chicken stuffed down the toilet.
You call that rational, do you?
Certainly. Everything I do is rational.
Why have you put chickens down the lavatory?
To thaw them before dismemberment.
You're ill, darling. I want you to get out of the bath.
They feed them on fish. They taste like fish. So I shall dismember them and return them via the sewers to the sea.
Get out of the bloody bath!
She thinks he's gone nuts. He knows he's finally gone sane. His only problem is that he still has to deal with pimples. A very large, red, pulsating one has developed on his neck. It's so nasty that he starts to think it has a life of its own. Maybe the very same life in advertising that Bagley has rejected. One morning, he looks in the mirror and finds the pimple has grown hair and eyes and a little mouth. It talks. It even compliments his wife on her cooking.
Mmm, smells good. Smells thumb-sucking good.
Thank you, darling.
That's all I can tell you in good conscience about the plot of Bruce Robinson's hilarious How to Get Ahead in Advertising. Here's a comedy that combines a literate screenplay with some of the most uproariously lurid special effects since Alien. As Bagley, the bedeviled ad man, Richard E. Grant gives the sort of exhibition of multiple personality that, in earlier times, would have won him an exorcism followed by a trip to the stake. It's a virtuoso portrait of a man possessed, and Rachel Ward, as his wife Julia, fully holds her own against him. How to Get Ahead in Advertising ultimately feels slight, like a clever short story worked up into a full-length production. But right now, I can't think of a smarter, funnier movie.
Stuart Klawans also reviews films for The Nation. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, journalist Pete Hamill looks back on the 1950s, the decade his new novel is set in. So I hope you can join us, and we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.